I hope everyone enjoyed their lunch and is ready for some more great content from our speakers. Our first session after lunch is all about CBDCs and stablecoins. I'm not going to lie, I had no idea what that meant, so I did some Googling, and it stands for Central Bank Digital Currency, I'm pretty sure. Yep, thank you. Not sure if I'm the only one here that didn't know that, but on our panel today to teach us all about it, we have Effie Dimitropoulos from Novartis, Nigel Dobson from ANZ Bank, Ursula McCormack from King & Wood Mallesons, and Ellis Connolly from the Reserve Bank. And our moderator for this panel is Daniel Knight from K&L Gates. Welcome to our panel.
Thanks, everyone, and great to be speaking with you today. I'm not sure if people can hear me up the back. I think I heard someone say no. All right, we might hope, maybe once that door gets closed, we might be able to, hopefully everyone can hear, maybe if the volume can go up a little. Thanks everyone for coming. Look, great to be talking about these issues. What a difference 12 months makes. With so many of the sessions through the conference so far, I'm reminded just how much the sector has changed and evolved since the last Intersect, and certainly no exception when we're talking about CBDCs and stablecoins. I think it's one of the themes that seems to emerge from the agenda is just how many sessions are focused on payments issues and on crypto issues. And this session, I think, sits uniquely at the crossroads of both and at a really interesting space too in terms of innovation, regulation and sort of product evolution. And so we have that sort of spectrum represented on the panel here today, keen to talk about all those issues. So I might start with you, Ellis. Can you just tell us who you are and your interest in these issues?
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Daniel. I'm the head of payments policy at the Reserve Bank of Australia, and our mandate is to promote the efficiency, competitiveness and safety of Australia's payment system. And as part of this, we have an interest in where we're going to end up with on a regulatory framework for stablecoins. We're also doing quite a lot of research on central bank digital currencies. We've got a very open mind on the way forward there. And our focus at the moment is on use cases for CBDCs in Australia.
Great. Thanks, Ellis. Effie?
I'm Effie Dimitropoulos from an Australian Stock Exchange listed company called Novartis. We specialise in payments. I look after the division that has alternate payments, cross-border China payments, as well as stablecoin. So for us, stablecoin has been a natural progression within the payments ecosystem. And so we, as you probably may have seen in some announcements, are launching an Australian dollar stablecoin, the AUDD, and that's why I'm on this panel representing fintechs in this space.
Great, thanks, Evie. Nigel.
Hi, good afternoon. Nigel Dobson, Banking Services Lead at ANZ. My responsibilities cover enterprise payments and operations and strategy. And we've also launched a dollar DC stablecoin back in March, and we think that is the fundamental building block for the token economy, which I'm sure we'll talk about during the course of the panel.
Great, thanks, Simon. Ursula?
Hi, everyone. I'm Ursula McCormack. I'm with King & Wood Mallesons. I'm a lawyer by trade, and my practice is based in Asia mostly, but now dual basing with Sydney. So a lot of my work is in the Asian markets, worked with the Chinese government, the Hong Kong government, and now with the Bank of International Settlements on CBDC projects up there, and more recently working with some of the banks down here on looking at their stablecoin products as well as some of the crypto exchanges on their solutions.
Great, okay, thank you. And for my part, I'm a partner at K&L Gates. My practice is financial services, fintech regulatory issues as well. So lots to dive into today. Ellis, we might start with you. So the Reserve Bank, obviously, like lots of other central banks around the world, is in the midst of a CBDC research project, or research projects. Can you tell us where you're up to, what the thinking is at the moment, just how open your open mind is about CBDCs?
Absolutely. Thanks very much, Daniel. Look, our open mind is very, very open on these issues in terms of the way forward for CBDCs. What I would say is today, we're not yet convinced that there's a public policy case to, say, issue a retail central bank digital currency in Australia. The reason for that is pretty simple. We have a modern and pretty efficient payment system. People can make cheap, fast, and safe payments in Australia. If people want to use a central bank currency, there's still pretty good access to cash. And there's plenty of innovation going on as well. if you think about the adoption of digital wallets and also all the great work going on in fast payments using the NPP. So it's not clear yet that we need to add to that a retail central bank digital currency. The story is a bit different on the wholesale side. You could imagine at some point in the future there could be a wholesale CBDC that could assist with the settlement of tokenised assets, for instance. This isn't a world away from what the Reserve Bank already does with its real-time gross settlement system. We have exchange settlement balances which financial institutions can use to settle wholesale transactions. So it's not a huge leap from that form of electronic money that's already out there to a wholesale CBDC. But in any case, we want to make sure that Australia is well positioned for the future here. So we've been doing quite a bit of research on central bank digital currencies over the past few years. Several of our projects have been focusing on proofs of concept to really explore technical and design issues around CBDCs. We're pivoting now to really answer that public policy question of whether there's a case for CBDCs by looking at potential use cases. And that's very much the focus of the research collaboration that we recently announced with the Digital Finance CRC to look at use cases for CBDCs in Australia. The plan will be that we'll issue a pilot CBDC. So this is a step up from the proofs of concept that we've done so far in that it would actually be an actual claim on the Reserve Bank. Our plan will be over the next couple of months to put out a white paper that describes the platform in a bit more detail, and then we'll put out an expression of interest to industry to find out what sort of use cases that you would like to test on this platform. We've got a very open mind, whether they're wholesale or retail use cases. The one thing we would ask is we're particularly interested in use cases where you can't implement that easily just using the existing payment system. So we can really get at that question of, do we need a CBDC in Australia? So we're really looking forward to engaging with you all. Feel free to come and have a chat to us over the next couple of days. You can also register your interest in the project on the website of the Digital Finance CRC.
Great, thanks, Ellis. And so for you, Nigel and Effie as well, I mean, do you see the role of a CBDC at a retail level in Australia?
From we're obviously keeping a very close eye on your research because we do want to understand where you may end up in that retail space, because I think from our perspective, we think that the private industry and the private sector is probably more suited to the retail space, just based on the role we currently play within the payments area. So a wholesale CBDC, like you said, we want to see what the outcome is and whether that makes sense. From our side, a retail CBDC, probably a stablecoin might be the outcome or the output that we believe would play a better part in that space for digital tokenisation. And I think, Philip Lowe talked at the G20 saying basically that token payments are probably better suited to the private industry and stablecoins, as long as there was a regulatory framework that could support it. And so that's the thinking that we have at the moment.
Great. Thanks, Eddie. Nigel?
Well, yeah, look, I agree with Ellis. I think our traditional payments industry is pretty well evolved here. And so it's hard to make a case if you think about a CBDC as a payments instrument. And as I said in my opening, we look at our stablecoin as a building block to the token economy. So it's built to interact with other digital assets natively in the venues that where those assets exist and wish to trade. And if you look at the crypto markets right now, 50% of the traffic in crypto exchanges is in stablecoins, right? 50%, billions of dollars. So there is a demand for these, but there's also a place for these as well. And I think that's the right way to frame this up. I'm not sure that there is a case to be made for CBDCs. I think there will be one, I'm sure, or two. but they're most likely to coexist with stablecoins issued by commercial banks and non-banks, who probably have their focus on interacting with digital assets, particularly where their customers have a need for tokenisation.
Yeah, great, thank you. And there'll be lots more for us to say on stablecoins. But before we do that, Ursula, I might throw to you, with your practice across Asia, how are you seeing these issues play out differently in Asia?
Yeah, let me start with the unifying factor. And the unifying factor is that all around the world, governments are experimenting, banks are experimenting, and they're experimenting because there's a need to innovate money. How it's expressed, how it's transacted, how it interacts in the digital economy that's really building and blossoming all around it and not interacting all that well with traditional fiat. And so that's the unifying factor. And in some advanced markets that have got, amazing payment rails, the need for further innovation into a CBDC, is less persuasive than it is in markets that lack fundamental banking services or even banks themselves. So if you look at the Pacific, for example, you have archipelagos of hundreds of islands with not, unfortunately, an ANZ branch, locally there to provide the necessary cash or, frankly, some of the internet infrastructure that's even needed to take that next step. But generally speaking, what we see is that most jurisdictions are starting to look at either the opportunities that are posed by creating a central bank digital currency, or on the flip side, they're looking at the risks of not doing so, or the challenges and headwinds that they're facing. So for the opportunities, it might be digital economy engagement, it could be things like even breaking the hegemony of the US dollar, which can be a really persuasive point, or it can be things like bribery and corruption controls in certain markets. So in terms of then the what, we have some markets like mainland China pursuing a retail central bank digital currency, Europe as well looking very closely at retail, each of those for different reasons. So in the case of mainland China, you've got very strong capital controls that exist. You had market bans around crypto that were implemented in 2017 and a really intense focus on stemming bribery and corruption, using payment rails for things like Belt and Road and so on. But even then, you have a system that relies on banks. It's still not a direct relationship that you have as a holder with your central bank. And that's where I think that the overlap into stablecoins becomes super important, which we'll discuss. But the other key trends that we see are also jurisdictions that are agnostic or looking for those use cases. So Japan's a good example where it's set down principles for its experimentation. It's recognised the ongoing role of cash, which is still very critical to the Japanese economy, but while considering how it might experiment. Hong Kong, on the other hand, has put out a global fast-track program, and one of the subsets in a competition-like format is to develop use cases as well as technological solutions to issues like privacy.
Yeah, fantastic. Okay, really dynamic space. Thank you for that insight. Nigel, just on the stablecoin. So, I mean, you've talked about ADC. Can you talk to us a bit more about what's on the horizon for ANZ in this space?
Sure. Look, as I said, the purpose of ADC is to interact with digital assets. And, we've already done a number of experiments. One is with a company called Convergence Tech, which was a government-funded piece of work for a POC on the distillery industry, where the manufacturing alcohol was tokenized for the purposes of paying, sending messages for the payment of excise tax to the ATO, which was also a counterparty in the experiment, and our stablecoin was the means of payment. So what that demonstrated was a real life example of a supply chain, a physical supply chain, where tokenization, smart contracts, and automation can play into a much improved supply chain process and taxation process for the ATO, and our smart contract coin was able to deliver that excise tax to the ATO. So that's just a real world example of how better, faster, cheaper can be achieved with a number of services and parties interacting. And the other one we're very passionate about is in the sustainability space around the tokenization of carbon credits. And we believe this is a market that will become more important in the next few years, but also needs to mature. The infrastructure in the carbon markets is disparate. It's not standardised, and it's pretty. We do carbon credits today, OTC, like 1983 on the phone. And so there's a lot of room for improvement in the carbon markets, both here in Australia and abroad. So the tokenisation of carbon credits, when we work with a company called Better Carbon, and they have tokenised ACCUs, Australian carbon credit units, and we did a transaction using, again, our stablecoin to buy and sell a tokenized ACCU. And we think that's an example where tokenization can play not only a role for improved distribution, but also transparency and the build out of infrastructure. And then the second order piece across that narrative is the emergence of NFTs. Now, they've already emerged, clearly, but in the carbon space, we are looking to go all the way back to point of origin of the carbon, right, the carbon offsets, and verify the credentials of the offset, the producer, and then tokenize that in an NFT so that the buyers, the offsetters or the investors can say, well, not only do I have an ACCU, but I've also got one that came from Northern Territory Indigenous Carbon Network or something of that nature. So you can get that verified credential into an NFT and create a secondary market, which we believe will trade at a higher rate, a higher price than some of the standard ACCUs.
Okay, great. Yep. Thanks, Nigel. Now, Effie, I know Novati's also got its, got a project underway for a stablecoin. Can you tell us a bit about where you're up to on that project and use cases and so on?
Absolutely. So, unlike ANZ, we actually, you're quite right, we're launching that soon. So if I can rewind to talk a little bit about the fact that Novati has been in the payment space for over a decade. And unlike a bank, and as a fintech, we've been dealing with a number of fintechs, and not only in Australia, so to the point of the payment system here in Australia might be robust and easy and efficient as it is today, our business also has a global focus. So we've been dealing in both cross-border payments, remittances, settlements, transactions that interact outside of Australia. And so that's where you start seeing some of those inefficiencies. And so what we're looking to do with the stablecoin, which again, it's slightly different, it's actually going to be on a public blockchain. So
is ours.
Okay. Permissioned?
Permissionless.
Permissionless, okay, sorry. Okay, so well, ours then, yeah. So our focus and our priorities is basically augmenting the existing services that we're offering. We've innovated with alternate payments, whether that be QR coded payments, voucher payments, the digital money, e-money, digital wallets, all of that sort of stuff. So for us, this is a natural progression to incorporate a mechanism by which, you can do stablecoin transactions between one, an AUD stablecoin and a stablecoin from another jurisdiction. So, for an instant settlement that doesn't require a 9-to-5 or a 5-day-a-week mentality, you've got a 24/7 autonomous access to making settlements and payments. And so that's obviously important for, importers, exporters, just the cross-border remittance space. So that's where we see our initial use cases will lie, and then we'll obviously expand from that. There are many of other use cases, and we're looking forward to possibly participating in either proof of concepts or something that makes sense from a payment space with the RBA and other players.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Effie. And you mentioned cross-border payments. I want to unpack that a bit, because I think what we're seeing at the moment is various different central banks looking at CBDCs on their own with different technologies and different systems, and obviously stablecoins. We've got two on the panel. And there will be a poll at the end, who's got the best stablecoin. But there's...
Well, ours isn't out. They're ahead. That's
okay.
Unfair.
There's proliferation of different technologies. I'm interested in how we get to a place where there's interoperability, where cross-border payments are smoother than they are at the moment. So, I mean, Ursula, do you want to comment on how you're seeing that challenge being solved across Asia?
Yeah, look, so with stable coins, they play a really critical role in the virtual asset economy and in virtual asset exchanges. And some of the forces behind that are not only the benefits that they bring in terms of speed and atomic settlement, but also because, frankly, a lot of the exchanges have been debanked or just cannot access banking. And that's a reality and the topic of another session that Austrac is leading. But that's sort of one reality. But the upshot is that you have assets that can move very quickly cross-border themselves to be able to settle obligations or be able to trade or be able to temporarily hold value while you wait until your next trade. But also we see the likes of USDC and others used as the settlement layer for fiat end-to-end transactions. So the users on either side only ever see real money, fiat money, but at the back end you've got the transaction occurring with that asset. And if you look at even what XRP was intended to be, Ripple had the system around to kind of renovate correspondent banking, but XRP was intended at the time to be that settlement asset behind the scenes. So that's sort of a key one. But linking back into CBDCs, the other thing that we're seeing is the experimentation at the wholesale level is around settlement between central banks and commercial participants, including banks, at that central bank level. And that's examples of, like Project Dunbar, which I think ANZ was, or RBA was involved in, and then Enbridge, which is something that I've been involved in.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Nigel, do you have a view about that, how the role that stablecoins can play in that cross-border payment?
Oh, certainly. I mean, Effie mentioned it, and I think it's really a profound point, is 24/7 and they settle atomically, right? Which I think was Ursula's point amongst many. But that's the uplift, right? Is that, decentralized networks don't need to go home and see their families at night, right? They just are always on. And they are, many of them are interoperable through EMV standards, and standards really matter. And that's why we went public permissionless, right? Because the ERC20 token that we issued can traverse a number of blockchains. So we can be blockchain agnostic, we can delve into a range of venues and help our customers who may have chosen certain blockchains for certain reasons, and we can deliver to their needs. And so I think that's really important. Standards, 24/7, and atomic settlement is where you get the cross, and in particularly in a cross-border scenario, where you get this massive uplift in operational improvement, so cheaper, faster, better. And I think that's where the direction of where stablecoins will be used in a corporate commercial sense in the future.
Yeah, great. Okay, thank you. Now, Ellis, we know stablecoins is an area of focus for regulators in Australia, how they might be regulated and when. Can you give us any insights of what you're seeing, perhaps in your discussions with other regulators?
Sure. Yeah. Firstly, I'd just say we do see potential for well-designed, well-regulated stablecoins to make a contribution to providing better services for Australian households and businesses. So we do see a future which could involve well-regulated stablecoins, but it's really important that we get the regulation of this right. There are potential consumer protection issues, in particular, potentially financial stability issues if stablecoins were to be used very broadly. And the issues we saw earlier in the year with the volatility in crypto markets, with the issues around algorithmic stablecoins, it's emphasised that there really is a need for a good regulatory framework in this space. So we've been working with the other Council of Financial Regulator agencies, particularly thinking about the stablecoins that could be used for payments. So these are the ones that have similar characteristics to currency or money. The philosophy we approach this with is one of same activity, same risk, it should have the same regulation. So in that context, when we look at stablecoins, they're pretty similar in their functionality to stored value facilities. So we think they should be regulated in a similar way. The approach we have to stored value facilities is really what we want to be able to achieve, is a framework that can give consumers confidence that if they purchase a stored value facility, such as a stablecoin, that they'll be able to extract their value from it at the other end. Ways this can be done is by having stablecoins backed with high quality collateral, or they can be prudentially regulated in a way equivalent to the way deposits are. This is what can help to provide consumers with that confidence. In terms of the way forward, the Council of Financial Regulators thinks we should be incorporating the regulation of stablecoins for payments purposes in with stored value facilities as part of the work the government is doing in generating a licensing regime for payment service providers. And one of the big benefits of doing it as part of that licensing regime is it should generate the potential for non-banks also to be able to issue stablecoins in future, which consumers can rely on.
Great, thanks, Ellis. And I guess that's another area where there's overlap between the work that Treasury is doing on payment service provider licensing, as well as that separate project around token mapping. And so you've got this overlap with stablecoins sort of sitting across both. So thank you for that perspective. You touched as well on sort of market issues. You can't have a panel about stablecoins without talking about Terra Luna. So, I mean, if you, Nigel, thoughts about how, you know, has there been sort of fatal damage to the brand of stablecoins? How does that get revived?
I think it just helps people differentiate the different flavours of stablecoin. And I think that, you know, we've been steadfast in our discussions with our regulators around how our coin works and that it's fully cash-backed and that, you know, its par cannot be broken. I think the Terra Luna example shows a little bit of the hubris of the DeFi markets in you know, advancing perhaps doing a little bit of an Icarus moment, and look, good for them. That was an incredibly innovative concept, and for as long as it lasted, it was an extraordinary project. But then it didn't, and so you know these things all new technology must be tested. And even if it's, it causes its death. We've used that example not only to contrast our stablecoin, but also to probably amplify the benefits of a commercial bank, a fully cash-backed stablecoin being issued into the market for our customers. And I think that's how we've approached that.
I'm just going to say, wow, did anybody even know what an algorithmic stablecoin was before the Terra Luna thing? I mean, certainly when, and I'm sure even you guys, when you approached it, when you thought of the word stable, you went, okay, well, stable means backed by something that's transparent, that is, you know, that people can see, that they can touch, that they can feel. And this idea of, rushing to market with an algorithmic stablecoin, whilst I agree, innovative, great, good run for it, but... there's history when you've got 80, 90 years of a banking system and a share system that, you know, you can work off data and you can work off trends and what have you. And then this guy comes out in the market and all of a sudden, you know, whew, the market just blows up. So I think it's been good because we've been able to start distinguishing, identifying, categorising and talking about what you know, obviously we both believe is the right way to go with stablecoins. And I think it's a bit of a cautionary note to say, you know, also with regulation, don't rush into it, get it right. So look at it from all angles, all perspectives, and, you know, it is new. It is still relatively new. So let's not, you know, rush to come up with a regulatory framework that might not suit the purpose. So, you know, and we're very open about talking with regulators about this as well.
Fantastic. Thank you. And I think that brings us to time. So thanks, everyone, for being here for this session. There's obviously lots more we could talk about in this space. There is another panel tomorrow looking at CBDC issues, I'm aware, and lots of other discussions, obviously, about changes to payments regulation throughout the agenda. So why don't you thank the panel. Thanks for your insights, everyone.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.